Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network's Middle East Studies podcast. I'm Ruben Silverman, a research assistant at Stockholm University's Institute for Turkish Studies. And with me today is Devrim Adam Yavuz, an assistant professor of sociology at Lehman College. Today, we will be discussing his new book, Democracy and Capitalism in Turkey, The State, Power, and Big Business, published in 2023 by IB Taurus Press. It looks at the surprisingly active role that powerful business people have played in Turkey's democratization. Now, first, I'd like to welcome you to the program and ask you if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became focused on topics relating to Turkey and business and democratization.
Hi, Ruben. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk about my book with the New Book Network. I should say that I have an academic curiosity or interest in the various forms, either negative or positive, the relationship between capitalism and democracy takes or took historically across many cases. And I think that this is partly shaped by, I would say, my personal family history. And that might explain why I got interested in Turkey and Turkish business as well. I'm half French and half Turkish. And even though I spent my childhood in Turkey, I lived between the two cultures. And as a result, I came of age during the military coup of 1980 in Turkey. I was around 7 or 8 when it happened. And for listeners who might not know much about the coup, the military had stepped in for various reasons, among them trying to stop fighting between the extreme right-wing and left-wing political factions in the country. But they also wanted to implement primarily what social scientists, as social scientists, we might call neoliberal economic policies. And in a nutshell, they sought to limit the size of the government and the economy. They wanted to liberalize trade, and they wanted to open the Turkish private sector to competition. So they were abandoning the previous protectionist industrialization policies that Turkey implemented. As a kid during that time, I kind of, the period was fascinating because I lived it in two different ways. The first one was I went from a period where there were shortages in the country. I remember my parents would send me to every neighborhood corner store or deli to see if they had any coffee left, and I would walk for minutes from store to store. We went from that to the next year having new novelty items such as VCRs and Converse sneakers that free market economics economy had made possible. But at the same time, it was also a period where there was political repression. The military kind of jailed many political opponents to the coup. And they limited wages. And people believed that the Turkish business elite that I ended up writing years later had precipitated the military coup. And so I grew up kind of vilifying the capitalist class, which I saw kind of as supporting the coup. I mean, it might seem that I was too young to think about these things, but my dad was an academic, and I was always playing among left-wing adults who would talk about these topics. So I grew up vilifying the capitalist class. But at the same time, I also had experienced France, and which might be the more typical example of what we imagine when we think of a liberal democratic nation that has undergone a period of capitalist development. So I kind of also saw that there was a positive relationship between capitalism and democracy possible. And so I grew up with this tension in my mind, like that there was the promise of capitalism and democracy working well together, but also instances where they didn't seem to quite work together, that capitalism was associated and capitalists we associated with authoritarianism. So when years later in the 1990s, Turkish business leaders started to press for increased democracy in Turkey and started to really attack the political elite, the military, the state for the lack of democracy in the country, it was really surprising to me. And it kind of, I felt that it could be a good, fruitful way for studying the relationship between capitalism and democracy, that I was interested in it since childhood.
Well, so if Turkey is an example of, at least it seems to you, the business elite attacking the military, playing a role in democratization, how does this fit into sort of larger scholarly discussions about the role of business elites and democratization? Does what happened in Turkey seem to prove things scholars are arguing, or does it challenge the common understanding of this topic?
I would say yes or no. It both challenges and proves. And this is why I feel I like the topic, not only in the context of Turkey, but in the history of Western Europe and its industrialization, or in the history of Latin America. So the field of political or historical sociology that I'm active in, it likes empirical puzzles or contradictions in order to advance knowledge. And the relationship between capitalism and democracy encapsulates this contradiction because when you look at historically, you look at full liberal democracies around the world, they all seem to be wealthy and seem to have undergone a period of capitalist development. And when we kind of look at institutions such as the rule of law or protection from arbitrary state power, we could see that the democracy and capitalism in a way have aspects that go hand in hand. And that's why even at the time, Marx recognized this and said that the bourgeoisie was the political or the class in Western Europe that championed democracy. However, it's also within even the example of advanced liberal democracies, such as the US, it's possible to notice a tension between capitalism and democracy. And we could see how in the US, for instance, business can hurt pluralism through big political donations, through anti-union organizing, and through, among other things, income inequality. And I would say that, so there are instances where historically business's role has been positive, instances where it has been negative. And in countries like Turkey, this is maybe more marked because in Turkey, the business elite traditionally benefited from the authoritarian practices of the state. It was receiving directly subsidies from the state, who was trying to co-opt business to support its authoritarian practices. It also, maybe limited freedoms that also limited labor's rights. And so the following puzzle emerges. Like, we see democracy sometimes being associated with capitalism, that we see business sometimes pushing for democracy, but at other times we see business benefit from authoritarianism. So I would say that Turkey represents an interesting puzzle in the sense that it represented a case where business historically benefited from authoritarianism, but started to push for democracy. And we saw this around the same period, for example, Brazilian industrialists who were supportive of the military government in the 1960s and 70s started to even protest in the street in the 80s to ask for more democracy. And so in a way, I think that looking at the political business, the political position of business leaders in late industrializing nations such as Turkey or Brazil kind of helps look at this puzzle in a new way. We could try to see if there are factors under capitalism that can make a more conservative force become more liberal democratic over time. And I like the fact that Turkish business helped look at that puzzle.
Well, in the book, I mean, beyond just Turkish business, the sort of the main actor, the main institution you're looking at is this organization called TÜSİAD, which is an organization that represents some of Turkey's largest holding companies. So maybe we can talk a little bit about what those are, what holding companies are, especially for listeners who may not be that familiar. And how do they emerge in Turkey? How does a business, these large businesses, develop in Turkey up until, say, the 70s when TÜSİAD emerges?
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to clarify what holding companies are. And because I think that understanding them might help understand the pro-authoritarian position of Turkish capitalists historically, and also might help understand why they pressed for democracy later. And so, as you said, TÜSİAD, the Turkish Association of Business and Industry, was formed to represent the political interest of holding-owning families. So Turkish holdings are corporations that are typically owned and controlled by one family. So they're not really owned or controlled by shareholders, the same way we might be used to seeing firms in the U.S. Or in places like England. And the other feature is that they are active in many different sectors. So if your listeners ever travel to Turkey, an interesting game that they can play is to look at the different products or services that they use well in Turkey and try to see if they can identify the logo of a ram that kind of belongs to Koç Holding, or the SAE suffix that belongs to Sabancı Holding. These are the two biggest corporations in Turkey. And they will soon notice that they produce everything from bottled water to appliances to kind of food products to owning supermarket chains. So it's very unusual for people in the West to see kind of companies own so many seemingly unrelated products. And so they are, I would define them as corporations owned by one family who are active in many different sectors. And the reason for why the Turkish private sector came to take this shape, it came to be dominated by these families, is historical. And there are several explanations for it. And by the way, I'd like to open a small parenthesis for your listeners who really like, economic history and these types of, the history of industrial organizations such. An amazing book is on Turkey is Business and the State in Modern Turkey by Ayşe Burra, who explains their origin and their history in great detail, to the point where the business leaders I spoke to when researching the book kept emphasizing that that was one source that I needed to read. So even they agreed that it was a good expose of how they came to be. But historically, since the 19th century, Turkey's minorities, the Armenians, Greeks, and Jews, have really decreased in size because of various ethnic cleansing policies. Originally, they were the capitalist class in Turkey. So the state needed in the 20th century to kind of try and promote a new class of capitalists. And the way they did that was through subsidy to industry. And entrepreneurs would compete to get subsidies in order to enter into new sectors that the state wanted to. And once an entrepreneur managed to get a subsidy to be active, to build a factory and to be active in one sector, it was very easy for them to, whenever a new competition for a new construction project or a new to building a new factory came about for state subsidies, it was very easy for them to obtain those subsidies because they had experience in industry. As a result of that, they basically grew both in size and in the diversity of activities that they were engaged in. And I would say that this is an important aspect in understanding the position of business in Turkey, and maybe similar late industrializing nations where state subsidies have been so prevalent and business have been concentrating. On the one hand, I think that business is strong enough to kind of be active in many different sectors in obtaining subsidies. But on the other hand, they're also politically weak because they are dependent on the state and the state elite for handouts historically. And I would want to also add the fact that for the topic and the issue of democracy, to have such concentration and diversity of activities was important for holdings as well. Because unlike business people who are focused in only one or two sectors, large corporations who are really active in many different sectors were able to have a more bird's eye view of the capitalist system and what capitalists need as a whole to be competitive. And I think that's also key in understanding their demands in later years.
Mm. So in that case, why did they, these holding companies, why did so many of them come together in the 1970s and form something like TÜSİAD? What were they trying to accomplish?
So to understand why TÜSİAD and the major families or major holding owning families came together to found TÜSİAD, we have to know or be clear about the fact that there were already organizations in Turkey, such as like Chambers of Commerce and Industry, that were founded by the state to represent members of the private sector. So the owners who founded TÜSİAD did this in addition or to supplement existing organization. And there are two reasons, I should say, they did not find existing organizations that had been created by the state efficient. First, their votes in these organizations really was equal to the vote of other entrepreneurs. So the size of their enterprise, the number of sectors they were active in, wasn't weighed. It didn't, their economic power didn't factor in when these organizations gave a voice to people. They had, like, the owner of the largest corporation in Turkey had in these organizations as much say as a small local store owner or the owner of a craft shop somewhere. So it wasn't really representative of how powerful they felt economically. They felt that they should have more of a say within these organizations. Second, and related to this point, they felt that these organizations were not independent enough from the political classes. Political leaders in the 50s and 60s used these organizations to distribute rent and hand out to smaller business owners in order to get their support during elections. And so they wanted to really form a smaller lobby group that would be where membership would be voluntary and based on invitation only. You needed to be invited by two existing members. They really wanted kind of a select group of corporation owners to participate. That's why they formed it, because of the inadequacies of existing associations. I should also add that, you know, we mentioned before when I was discussing the state subsidies and how corporations were getting bigger and more diverse. It should be noted that the listener could imagine that subsidies that these corporations had received since the 1950s for about 20, 30 years were so focused on a few corporations that they really became very sophisticated and complex as private sector organizations. And so the type of state intervention that they needed, for example, they wanted to import sophisticated technology to get into high-tech sectors. They wanted skilled workers. They didn't really need to kind of repress workers to have low-wage, unskilled workers. They wanted to conduct more high-tech production. Or for that reason, their interest was diverging from the rest of the private sector. And I would say, too, there is an ideological and political leg to this. Because they had become more important in their sector of activity, they had become more sophisticated in terms of the types of economic activity they were in, they also felt more legitimate politically and ideologically. I think that they really felt more confident in their power to kind of have a say in the direction that the country would take. I mean, I think that in the U.S. nowadays, where I live, with tech bros who kind of seem to have an opinion about everything, including the humanities and higher education, I think we're used to having business people who say whatever they want on any topic. But in a society where they were, as a class, relatively new and they were dependent on the state for handouts, it was kind of a new discovery to them to kind of think that they might have something to say about the country's development, the country's politics. So I think that by, having this organization, TUSIAD, was a way to lobby, but also a way to, in a way, formulate a business ideology and, define what it should look like.
Well, I want to come to the 80s, but first a question occurs to me, which is that while we're in the 70s, this is the period that, say, some of the left-wing people you were growing up around, this is the period where they concluded that an organization like TUSIAD was in favor of a coup or in favor of the military. Was there anything about TUSIAD in the 70s that kind of proves or encouraged that view of theirs?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, thank you for bringing up that issue. So TUSIAD, in a nutshell, what they did is in 1980, when civilian governments seemed unwilling, for good reason probably, to kind of take the stabilization package that the IMF was pushing on Turkey, they were unwilling to do economic reform, like do privatization or liberalize the economy, for fear that that would make them unpopular with the rest of society. QCL did something that was unprecedented for business leaders, published four full-page ads condemning the then elected government for their inability to implement good economic policy. And soon after, the tanks rolled in, cities and the military coup happened. And so, the people that I ran around with as a kid felt that was, in a way, an indication that Tusiad had precipitated the military coup of Turkey. And given that the military dictatorship implemented a lot of the policy changes Tusiad wanted, seems to confirm that. Interestingly enough, you would imagine that a pro-democracy or an organization like Tusiad that wants to become pro-democratic, when I asked them about the coup, you would think that the people associated with it would try to downplay it. But on the contrary, they seem to suggest that was an indication that the Turkish capitalist had become strong enough to affect policy. And they saw that almost as a good thing, not necessarily having supported the coup, but as a good thing that Tusiad was increasing business's voice, if it makes sense.
So during the coup and after the coup, what sort of changes did occur in Turkey? And how did these changes affect the relationship of the state and these business people and eventually start to change their views about democracy?
So I would say that, it was interesting because the coup as we said, the military junta came with the goal of implementing the type of economic reform that the business leaders wanted. They carried out a package of economic liberalization. So in a nutshell, opening up the Turkish economy to competition. And they also privatized some sectors of the economy that was previously under the control of state-owned enterprises. So, to make a long story short, they implemented free market economics that we would assume that business leaders would be in favor of. But I think that, in the 1980s, what happened is members of Tusiad started to experience both the promise and limits of free market economics. And they also started to notice that economic liberalization carried out by the military and by the subsequent center right wing government in 1983 under Turgut Özal, to open a small parenthesis, probably the second most influential politician in Turkey's history after Erdogan in the last 50 years, with them implementing economic policy without political reform or without reforming the state the way the state-society relations work, was counterproductive. They realized that, when we think about economic liberalization, one of the reasons at the time the IMF or other international bodies advocated the economic liberalization in Turkey and around the world was that they assumed that limiting the role of the government, of the state, would bring together good governance, less corruption, and more democracy. But I think that Tusiad and people in Turkey and, started to realize what sociologists had been saying all along, which is that decreasing the size of the state, the involvement of the state in the economy alone, doesn't really solve the problems of the economy, but you also need to have state reform, better government, less corruption. And the Özal government, despite its liberalization policies, started to continue distributing favors to its supporters. There was economic uncertainty as a result of that. And so the members of Tusiad I spoke to saw the period as one where You know, they had gotten what they wanted. They had obtained economic liberalization, but noticed that it didn't bring about good governance. And at the same time, I would say, they're economically, they were changing. They were even becoming more formal as organization than in the 1970s. They were becoming more high-tech. And so they really wanted changes in political institutions, too. They wanted a better education system to have high-skilled workers. They wanted better income equality, to have large markets that they could sell to. They wanted more certainty so that they could, have business partnerships with the rest of the world and import technology for high-tech production. And they noticed that they couldn't do that, that to do those things, you needed to have also a parallel political change to economic change. So I would say that the 1980s was, maybe we could call it, characterize it as like a sandbox. It was like a period where these capitalists got to play in the free market economy that they thought they wanted, but they realized how important good governance was also. And I think it was an awakening, we might call the period.
Also, the big event that I suppose we can say you focus on in the change, the transition of Tusiad's perspective, is in 1997, they issue this big democracy report. And so maybe we can focus on this for a few minutes, the Sun 97 report, and talk about how it came about, what they were arguing for, and what they were hoping to accomplish with something like this at this point.
Okay, so to give some context to the democracy report, I think that might be worth mentioning two things. The first one, Tusiad, in its attempt to kind of work as the voice of the private sector, had adopted the habit of publishing reports since the 1970s about issues that it felt were important to the private sector. It also, during that time, even though these reports were often commissioned and they were written by academics or scholars in the field, Tusiad and its leadership had decided that they should stick behind what these reports were saying. They should defend these reports. The second thing that is worth mentioning about this specific 1997 democracy report is that to someone who is from outside Turkey, it really seems to be like a very legalistic document that just takes the Turkish constitution and various laws regulating political life at the time and just dissects them and tries to explain how they can become more democratic. But it's worth emphasizing for listeners outside of Turkey, what that meant is that they started in that report discussing issues such as minority rights, such as, they felt that having a Turkish or ethnic definition of Turkishness in the introduction to the constitution was problematic. They also felt that the report underscored that you couldn't really impose Kemalism, a set of ideologies named after the founder of modern Turkey. You couldn't really impose that on every party that ran in elections, that, parties should be free to be Kemalist or something else, which the Turkish constitution did not really leave room for. So within the scope of outside of Turkey, these don't seem to be very scandalous or taboo issues, but in Turkey, they were new and taboo. And so I think that it was really quite a radical break to see holding owners that were, in a way, had depended on the state, owed their existence to the state, kind of come up with a set of propositions on how to make the country more democratic by tackling these taboo issues. I mentioned the word break a few times, but it should also be noted too that the report came about because, as I mentioned, in the 1980s, the holding owners and the leadership of TÜSİAD realized that something had to change. There needed to be state reform. So one thing that they had done or agreed on in the 1990s was to bring the younger generation, literally the heirs of Turkish holdings, into leadership positions in TÜSİAD, because they felt that they would be more vocal, they would be more willing to kind of take stronger positions against the political classes and against the state. And so the report was really commissioned by this younger generation, we could say, that was maybe more liberal, democratic, and more open to new ideas. But it should be emphasized that I think that the older generation, in a way, gave its okay to the new generation, because they placed them into leadership positions, knowing full well that this is the kind of actions that they would take. So the report, you know, like created a big scandal in Turkey. Some of the people I spoke to said that the business leaders were tickled, that they were summoned by state prosecutors to testify like political radicals. But, you know, to make a long story short, I think that the report was published because corporation owners, the holding owners, the TÜSİAD leadership, felt that was what was needed for a well-functioning capitalist economy.
Well, and one more thing, with you mentioning the sort of younger generation of leaders, that occurs to me. You write about how the interactions of some of these business leaders with, say, peers in Europe or America also sort of changed their norms, their ways of perceiving, like, what was the acceptable thing to support or not support, and that socialization also affected their perspectives. Is that an accurate way of putting it? Or
yeah, that's an excellent description, I would say, and I think that it underscores too, you know, like there is a lot of this, you know, when you think about issues such as capitalism and democracy, the link between them, there is, you know, a literature that sometimes overemphasizes the role of globalization, saying that these kind of global norms get spread. I mean, it's true to some extent, but I think that it's interesting to speak to these business people, because you kind of see the mechanisms through which they spread. I mean, first of all, some of them said that they were sick and tired of having to defend Turkey whenever they were at a business dinner somewhere in Europe, for example. Others mentioned too that in a way doing business with foreign companies, what it forced them to do was they are forced to adopt, you know, like more international norms of accounting. So they kind of adopt corporate governance structures, which makes it also hard to get into more nefarious dealings with state officials. So there, I would say that what's fascinating about the topic is that the changes are at all different levels. Ideologically, they were changing, but also the day-to-day operations of their businesses were changing as well. And they couldn't really maintain the same kind of relationship that they had with state officials anymore.
So let's move on to the last 20 years, the years of Vahke pay rule, and let's think about that maybe in decade by decade. So during the first 10 years of Vahke pay rule, the government seemed to be moving in a lot of the policy directions, at least economically, that TÜSİAD leaders might have wanted. But there was also many tensions between some of the major holding companies and the AKP. So what can we say about this and the institution? How did TÜSİAD relate to the AKP during this first decade of AKP rule?
I mean, I would say, I mean, Tizian's position in the first decade is interesting, not because it's peculiar, but it's interesting because it's complex. I would say, I mean, Tizian and its leadership found itself in the same predicament as many liberal democratic people from Turkey found themselves in. The AKP government presented the conundrum because on the one hand, when you look at the early days of the AKP, they seem to be willing to adopt some of the changes that liberal democratic Turks, including Tüsyan, wanted, such as joining the EU or doing changes like liberalizing the use of the Kurdish language. You know, there was that dilemma. Do you support, even if you're secular, do you support a government that might have a hidden agenda of making Turkey more religious, or do you support it for the democratic reforms that it, you know, promises to bring? And I think that Tüsyan found itself in that same kind of like dilemma. And I would say it should be, this is also as good a place as any to mention that you know, business leaders in Turkey are not a monolith. Some members of Tüsyan are more liberal democratic. And if you speak to, you know, people in Turkey, I think that they know who they are. For example, Cem Boyner, who's a young industrial tycoon who owns like a chain of clothing stores, even joined active politics. With kind of similar policies or policy proposals of liberating the Kurdish language and so forth. So it pleased, I would say, worried and pleased some members of Tüsyan, but others kind of were more conservative, and by more conservative, I would say maybe tied more to the values of the traditional state elite, which so we could say more Kemalist, in line with the founding principles of the Turkish Republic. And so there was a conflict with the Tüsyan. And I would say that the liberal democratic wing came on top just because they kind of, the same way that they resolved their debates around the democratization report, they kind of were able to remind their membership that democracy was what they agreed they needed to kind of have a well-functioning capitalist economy. I would say also in the case of Tüsyan, I remember talking to one of its leaders who said that they had been terrified when they saw Erdogan speak at a public event, because they felt that he was a dictator in the making. But at the same time, they agreed that, you know, the AKP had come to power with the promise of good government and with the promise that they would be also more into to input from civil society organizations like Tüsyan when managing the economy. And they said that you know, it seemed like in the first years, at least, the AKP was open to input and dialoguing with the private sector. Having said that, you might be aware, as someone who studied Turkey, that Recep Tayyip Erdogan, AKP's leader, the now president, never shied away from also adopting an anti-elite and anti-business discourse in public. I mean, there are even many meetings where he's face-to-face with Tüsyan leadership and accuses them to their face of being corrupt, of being thieves, and he threatens to eliminate them if they don't do what he wants. And so I think that the figure of Erdogan has always been as a populist figure threatening. On top of that, it should be emphasized that one of the biggest support bases of the AKP was more religious, smaller entrepreneurs from away from Istanbul and the main centers where the holdings are traditionally from. They, you know, Erdogan represented the interest of small business from the regions. And I think that for those reasons, we might think that Tusiad was in a way threatened by the AKP. But ultimately, I think that the promise of democracy and the fact that at the end of the day, small businesses from the regions were good for the private sector as a whole. It meant that Tusiad members had bigger markets to sell their products to. They were doing business with people in the regions. So overall, the economy was more dynamic too. So for those reasons, I would say that Tusiad's position was, or officially what it did was to really do a lot of public diplomacy activities in the EU with the government in order to try and make Turkey's candidacy into the EU possible. And so in a way, it tried to be, even though the government was menacing in many ways, it tried to kind of take advantage of the fact that it promised democracy at the time.
Well, so that brings us to the last decade. And I found the whole book interesting, but I particularly found this last part very interesting because I just hadn't honestly been thinking about how Tusiad has reacted this past decade to a situation in which the AKP no longer has much, I guess we'd say, respect internationally as like a champion of liberal democracy or anything of that sort. So under those circumstances, how has Tusiad organizationally presented itself, reacted to this? You talk about that in the last part of the book, and I found it very interesting. So if you could talk about that here too, I'd be wonderful.
Well, I'm glad that you found something in that chapter. Because I guess that the common impression that we all hold as scholars of Turkey is that there isn't, unfortunately, much room for civil society organizations to breathe and be active in today's Turkey because of all the crackdown on civil society organizations. And when you think about the fact that these big corporation owners, have been dependent on the state from the very first time that they were founded, it in a way might raise the question of whether they would also be shy along the AKP government. So I would say that the chapter has maybe a more cynical tone as well as a more optimistic tone, I would say. Like maybe the more cynical tone or conclusion that we can derive from the chapter is that, Tusiad, because they have members, because they have accumulated over the years so much economic power and economic capacity, they maybe don't need the government as much anymore. So on a economic level, maybe they don't feel as threatened. So that could be, when I think about the broader conclusion of democracy and capitalism, maybe one honest assessment would be to say that, business people are happy as long as they're making money. But at the same time, I noticed also that it has, in a way, tried to kind of use the infrastructure, I would say, built through Tusiad to kind of very subtly try to continue pressing for democracy. So I would say that's impressive on two levels. The first one, it's impressive on one level because it should be noted that a figure that you might know, Ruben, Aydın Doğan, but that your readers might not know, your listeners might not know, he was a media baron. He owned many publications and TV channels that were critical of AKP. And, eventually Erdoğan and the AKP, through kind of countless audits of his business, forced his hand, and he sold most of his media empire. So they didn't lead to the collapse of one of those holdings because he did not fall in line with them. Some people who know Tusiad well would tell you that people within Tusian didn't like Aydın Doğan that much himself, and that he was somewhat of an outcast even with that organization, that he didn't quite fit with the Sabancı's and coach of Turkey. But you have that example. You also had some of your more liberal listeners might know also the example of Osman Kamala, who's been in jail for I don't know how many years now for supporting civil society organizations that were critical of the AKP government. And, you know, even though he's not a very big corporation owner, he was a TÜSİAD member because, first and foremost, he was a business person also. So there are clear threads like that. But at the same time, so despite that, it should be noted that TÜSİAD was, you know, showed remarkable restraint by not supporting the military during that period. They still continue to meet with leaders of the Kurdish party, for instance, despite the fact that it came under threat from the AKP. But I would say that most importantly, what they did is the infrastructure they built as an organization. So this includes many think tanks in Turkish universities, some think tanks in Europe, as well as like missions in Washington, D.C. and so forth. What it has used that in a way, infrastructure, it has used it to kind of like come up with more micro level commentaries on other issues such as that are not necessarily democracy, like related, that are kind of democracy related, but without being critical of the government. So they've kind of discussed environmental issues a great deal more than they did before. They talk about issues relating to gender equality a lot more than they did before. They talk about education. So as someone from TÜSİAD I recently spoke to said, they kind of find ways to kind of say democracy without saying democracy. They have, in more recent reports that they've published, they kind of show the progresses that there were the things that the AKP government doesn't so do so well, or the things that Turkey could do on these several different dimensions to become more democratic. So they're not really saying things that are as radical as before, but I would say that they're finding ways to constantly be active in different democracy-related fields. And I think that they're trying to kind of push for change at the level of civil society, and maybe also trying to push the hand of the government in accepting like more international agreements that it is a signatory to and so forth. So it's on that level. Having said that, I mean, one risk, of course, like business people are, you know, often, I would say, you know, I think that TÜSİAD in the 1990s, it tempered the egos of its leadership because, you know, you had holding owners who now tackle big questions like democracy. So I don't know what focusing on these micro level, the minutiae of kind of environmental issues and so forth will, how it will affect business, if they would still be interested in participating in TÜSİAD actively. But that's like one outlet that I see for their democracy efforts.
Well, that's an interesting food for thought. I wanted to end up by asking you, just with this book done, finished, out there, what sort of things are you looking at, thinking about, working on now?
Well, right now I am working on, I'm at the early stages of a project on states, the nature of the state, state power, and COVID-19 interventions. The reason it might sound out of left field all of a sudden to talk about COVID, the reason that I got interested in the topic was something that had to do with my research on Turkey, which is, one thing that came out when I was speaking to these business leaders. was how many of them, despite being economically powerful, mentioned kind of being always at the mercy of the state. They all always were talking about the importance of the state. So the whole, I would say, book project on Tusiad made me also embrace, in a way, the literature on the state quite a bit. And so it's the kind of like state-centric historical sociology is an approach that I admire. And I feel that even though it sounds like it might be counterintuitive, people who feel that a pandemic like COVID-19 has been caused by, you know, global forces, globalization that also weakened the nation state, might think that looking at the state might not be the best way to understand the pandemic. But I feel that, you know, historical comparative sociology has given us the tools to understand why state intervention sometimes has been successful during pandemics, why it might have failed at others. So with a couple of colleagues, we're looking at measures of state power and whether they explain differences in vaccination rates. And I think that that will probably lead to a comparative book project where I end up comparing Turkey to the United States, to France, to see how whether differences in style of government also led to differences in the way pandemic preparedness rolls out moving forward. So that's one project that I'm hoping to accomplish over the next couple of years. After that, I want to revisit issues relating to business and democracy because, you know, I feel like Tusiad is one instance where business has adopted a pro-democracy stance. But I would like to write a book where I, you know, investigate all kinds of different vignettes about in business history and maybe look at more closely other instances where business has not been as pro-democratic. And so, but I don't know what the shape of that will look like yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, especially the first project on COVID, I think it sounds like you're hinting at some of the sociological theories and topics you talk about in this book as well, and maybe in this next project too. And I just want to say one strength of this book that we can't, you know, have time for and get across in talking is just how good a job I think you do of bringing in different sociological theories, bringing in different ideas, talking about them in very clear language and linking them to good examples from your interviews and from Turkish history. So I think the book is a really nice synthesis of these ideas and use of Turkey as an example. So I enjoyed reading it, and I hope other people find it, take the time to read it as well. It's quite good. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk.
Well, thank you for your kind words about the book and for taking the time to talk to me.